Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Speaking out of the city, on the road, making a new important documentary that I'll be premiering sometime in the fall. However, within a week of returning to the city, in 8 weeks from now, I'll be premiering two brand new feature films, important social documentaries. You haven't heard about them, haven't discussed them at all. I'll keep these under wraps till I'm back. Today, no guest. Instead, this is our day for health and healing and the latest on how we can live a longer life. But also, when I call back in earlier today and I ask, since I won't have anyone on asking questions, what are the issues that people are asking about? Several people have evidently emailed and asked about what do I believe would be a responsible response to those who believe that we should have a religious-based government, that there should be the teachings of Christianity within our government. Now, we do have that now. We have faith-based initiatives. We've had that for some time. Tens of millions of dollars a year of our taxpayer money goes to support these initiatives. Who are these people? Is this right? Well, it depends upon who you ask. On the one hand, if you ask, let's say, Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, they're going to say yes. And they keep talking about the founding fathers, and we should go back to that time. Okay, fair enough. Today, I'm going to take you back, and I'm going to share some insights from Rob Boston, Alternet, and my own understanding of history. A history lesson for a history professor. Newt Gingrich, you're supposed to be very knowledgeable in history. Well, why haven't you told the truth about the separation of church and state? We will on our program. Also, some of the things we should pay attention to that are not necessarily good news about health, but certainly will help us keep from getting sicker. And I'll give you all the latest on pain relievers, why you should be careful taking them or not taking them at all, and also sleeping pills. Really bad new information on sleeping pills. And also the lethal effects of genetically modified BT toxins, in this case, in some research. And one more reason that we're asking everyone to boycott all genetically engineered foods, at the very least demand labels on them, and then let's see if the public will buy anything that's genetically engineered, knowing the truth of what it does inside our body. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. First up, you rarely hear mushrooms talked about as being a superfood, but indeed they are a superfood. The shiitake mushrooms can lower your cholesterol. There are numerous scientific studies on that, and yet, whoever took a shiitake mushroom to lower their cholesterol? Probably no one. We also know that it's heart healthy. Again, no one thinks about mushrooms in your heart. The shiitake mushroom is just right up there with olive oil and oats when it comes to matching what they do for our heart. And yet they lack that kind of national promotion. You don't hear them written about. So I thought I'd give you a little insight. First off, what you have to understand is that there is a lot within that mushroom. Not just your folic acid, B complex, potassium and phosphorus, magnesium and fiber. That's true. But there are certain tiny nutritional components that enhance our immunity, that help us with better bone density, that help us with our weight management. All these extracts have a role. Now, mind you, what is a mushroom? A mushroom is a fungi, but it's a nutritional powerhouse. And U.S. ultraviolet light blasted mushrooms has increased their vitamin D content almost 800% and could present a non-dairy vitamin D source for a bone-healthy platform. So a call out for all of our healthy vegan eaters. Eat at least one full serving of mushrooms a day, that'll help you get your vitamin D. Also, when you cut your portobello mushroom and you cut it in, let's say, 2-inch blocks on a cutting board, that replaces meat. It has that mouthfeel, consistency, can be used in casseroles and dishes, and it's terrific for you. Now, mushrooms in and of themselves are a little bland tasting, but hey, you can use whatever seasoning you like, and suddenly it like tofu, it takes on the taste of what you're seasoning. So remember, when you are eating something, it's a living bacteria, and that's what a mushroom is. It's a living bacteria. It's very beneficial to our health, and it's something that we don't talk about. We should. I'd like to see more people eating the fungi for all the good things it does, from your immune system to your heart and lowering cholesterol. It does all these things, and it does it all in a healthy way. The white cap mushroom, that's good. The maitake, that's great. Shiitake, reishi, and the portobello. Those are the most common ones, but not the only ones. Oyster mushrooms are also gaining in popularity. Next up, a lot of men only think of breast cancer when it comes to women. Think again. Men can also develop breast cancer. In fact, every year, 3,000 men are diagnosed with breast cancer. Now, that's small compared to the 220,000 women diagnosed every year with breast cancer. But still, men, if you're a heavy drinker, you have lots of coffee, then there's a certain gene mutation called the BRCA1 and the BRCA2 that can make you more likely to develop breast cancer. And you have a higher percentage if you're a drinker. So drinking alcohol on a regular basis, not even if you get drunk, just social drinking, you increase your risk of breast cancer if you're a man. Also, another thing men do, and we've been indoctrinated to take this PSA test, and that prostate-specific antigen test, I've always thought was dubious. Now, this is the latest on this, and I'll quote this out of Reuters. Doctors criticize proposals by a government-backed panel recommending against prostate cancer screening in healthy men, saying they went too far and may put some men at risk of the deadly cancer. The U.S. Preventive Service Task Force, which advises the government on health prevention measures, just on Friday downgraded its recommendations on prostate cancer screening to a D, which means it recommends against the service, quote, because there's a moderate to high certainty that the service has no net benefit or that the harms outweigh the benefits. It had previously said that there was not enough evidence to make a call. Now it says that there is, and it's just not there. So why would there be a problem? Well, first off, higher increasing levels of PSA can indicate an increased risk of prostate cancer. But elevated PSA can also be caused by other things, like if you have an infection, you could have an enlarged prostate. Even if you had a recent ejaculation, that can raise your PSA. Studies have shown that a widespread use of PSA has resulted in high rates of false positive. And what happens when you have a false positive? You start getting chemotherapy or you get radiation. Well, what if you simply have no cancer and you're getting treated as if you are trying to prevent a cancer that would not exist? So don't get caught up into believing that just because everyone else is suggesting you to test, because the people more often not telling you to take the test are making money from it. Just another way that we do stupid things. University of California, a low-fat diet with fish oil supplements eaten for 4 to 6 weeks prior to prostate removal slowed down the growth of prostate cancer cells, the number of rapidly dividing cells in human prostate cancer tissue compared to a traditional, regular, high-fat diet. So understand something. One of the reasons that we get prostate cancer is because of a high-fat, high-animal protein diet. So if you go on a low-fat, no-animal protein diet, you really help prevent prostate cancer. And more men are making that turn. And I think that I'm very excited by that. And by the way, tomorrow I'll be calling in from on the road, and I'll be listening to the results of a independent medical biostatistician report on the 4-week arthritis study group that was completed. Now, there's two ways of reviewing this material. One is that I had hoped to show, starting with a hypothesis, nothing proven, that a statistically significant number of people and a group of controls would be measured for 4 weeks. And to get in, everyone had to have arthritis for at least 2 years, but the average was 7 years, and it was unremitting, meaning that there was no reduction in pain or swelling. They'd been on non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, a whole group of them, and some had arthritis for 22 years. Some were absolutely crippled by it. So what could happen in 4 weeks? Well, we had to do a whole series of studies and tests, and people kept diaries. And then I met, along with the other people on the team, every week for 4 weeks. We photographed them, interviewed them before and after. Then all that data is collected, the impedance test, the blood pressure, everything. And then that's given to an outside person who then does a complete statistical analysis, comes up with an answer. Did it work? Did it not? Did it significantly work or not? And I'm told that it's all done. And we'll find out, I guess, tomorrow. If it's before my program, I'll announce the results and I'll post them. This will be with charts and graphs and the whole protocol, so everybody who wants to benefit from it can. And then if it's statistically significant, I'll submit it for peer review, publication, and then submit it for scientific, let's say a seminar discussion where I could hopefully be invited to present this information, because this would be a groundbreaking study. This has never been done before. This would be a first in this area. And then if this works, then sometime in the fall, I'll do another one, maybe on lowering cholesterol or lowering blood pressure. That's good news. If indeed it is good news, I believe it will be, simply because of the feedback. I'm opposed to using diet sodas for many reasons. One, because they can leach out the minerals in the body, including diminishing calcium and zinc and magnesium, all of which are necessary for healthy digestion. But also they can help demineralize the bones. Here's one more reason. This is from a research that was recently done, Harvard School of Public Health, and it says the following. Researchers in the United States found a shocking association between violence by teenagers and the amount of soda they drank. High school students in inner city Boston who consumed 5 cans of non-diet, regular, you know, bubbly soft drinks every week, that's not even one a day, were more engaged in aggressive behavior than those who drank less. Quote, what we found was that there was a strong relationship between how many soft drinks that these inner city kids consumed and how violent they were. Not only in violence against peers, but also violence in dating relationships and against siblings. And that is from David Hemenway, professor at Harvard School of Public Health. Quote, it was shocking to us when we saw how clear the relationship was. Well, that was looking at 1,800 kids, 14 to 18 years old. Not shocking to those of you in the audience who've been listening to this program, because you remember when the late Dr. J. Philip Hodes, a really nice guy, managed to get us into the New Jersey prison system, where we were able to go in and do organic juices and supplements and foods to a group of in-stage AIDS patients and turn them around. But in the process, we were told that the violence turned around when the people were off all sugars and all dairy and all candies of all types. And they started detoxing, and as they detoxed, their level of violence went down. Well, that was also based upon work done by Dr. Schollenthaler and Dr. Alexander Schaus back in the 1970s, where they went into school systems and then prison systems, and as they got rid of the sugar and dairy, violence went down. And that also included the sugar in soft drinks. So this information to the people at Harvard is new. But then again, that's only because they're officially discovering what those of us who are not in the official field have known for a long time. Get rid of the soft drinks. For those of you who eat walnuts, and I hope you do, I hope you eat almonds, pistachios, walnuts, macadamia nuts, pecans. And if you do, eat them raw or eat the nut butters. They're living foods. Here's one more reason. This is from the Elaine Hardman of Marshall University School of Medicine, and it says, walnuts may help lower breast cancer risk. Quote from UPI, mice that ate a moderate amount of walnuts as part of their regular diet had a significant decline in breast cancer risk. And compared to the effects of a typical diet and those that contain no walnuts, and this was what would be equivalent to a human eating 2 ounces a day. 2 ounces be about a spoonful. That's not a lot of walnuts. The study, funded by grants from the American Institute of Cancer Research and the California's Journal of Nutrition and Cancer. Okay, walnuts. I believe we have over 41 studies in our own literature library. We have 500,000 studies, peer review, all from major institutions, showing the benefit, the health and safety of different foods and supplements. We'll add that to it. Quote, during the last century, the world population has shown a staggering increase in its proportion of elderly members and thus neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. They're becoming an increasing burden. Brain aging and neurodegenerative diseases of the elderly are, well, they're caused by oxidative damage, dysregulation of redox metal homeostasis and inflammation. You've heard me talk about this many times. And therefore, you need the support of therapeutic use of antioxidants. End quote. Scientists, Haifa University in Israel. That wasn't me saying that. That was them saying it. Quote, natural plant polyphenols, flavonoids and non-flavonoids, are the most abundant antioxidants in the diet and as such are ideal nutraceuticals for neutralizing stress-induced free radicals and inflammation. Human epidemiological new animal data suggests that green and black tea drinking, enriched by catechins, may help protect the brain against aging and reduce the incidence of dementia. End quote. That's the Technion Institute, Institute of Technology. The researchers concluded, quote, the scope of this review is to assess and put into perspective salient features of the benefit of brain action of natural non-toxic green tea catechins in aging, impaired cognitive and neurodegenerative diseases. And they found that it worked. How about that? And that was published in the peer-reviewed journal of Alzheimer's disease. Not bad. So good for the research team at Haifa University doing that. Lay language. Take your green tea. Take your red tea, oolong tea, white tea, black tea. They're all rich in neuroprotecting antioxidants. And we need them to help push down some of this. Now, Catholic University also published an interesting report. Quote, statins have been suggested to protect against Alzheimer's disease. Recently, however, we reported that aged dogs that underwent chronic statin treatment exhibited cognitive deficits compared with age-matched controls. And those were researchers in Rome. Quote, in human studies, blood levels of coenzyme Q10 decrease with statin use. And we know coenzyme Q10 is important for proper mitochondrial function and is a powerful antioxidant, two important factors for cognitive health and aging. Thus, the current study tests the hypothesis that coenzyme Q10 levels in the serum and parietal cortex are decreased in statin-treated dogs. So what they said, and this was published in the Journal of Neuroscience Letters, they said that the statins are not the answer because you need these enzymes, you need these coenzymes. And therefore, I'm against statins. I'm against all statins, and I believe that we need coenzyme Q10 instead. If you are a pregnant woman and you exercise, you're protecting your offspring against long-term neurodegenerative disease. This is from the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology. Quote, new research published in the Journal of the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology show that prenatal exercise improves brain plasticity, decreases toxic protein deposits, decreases inflammation, decreases oxidative stress, which helps ward off Alzheimer's and other diseases later in life. So for all the pregnant women, please exercise aerobically, all right? And finally, fruits and vegetables reduce the risk of specific types of colorectal cancer. This is from the American Journal of the American Dietetic Association. Quote, the effects of fruits and vegetable consumption on colorectal cancer appear to differ by site of origin, according to a new study published in their journal. Researchers found that within the proximal and distal colon, brassica, that is the Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, and broccoli, were associated with decreased risk, lower risk of cancers. And the lower risk of distal colon cancer was associated with eating apples. So the more apples you eat, the less cancer you have. Quote, fruits and vegetables have been examined extensively in nutritional research in relation to colorectal cancer. And then it goes on to talk about how you need your cruciferous. How about that? Because Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, and broccoli, what are they? They are the brassica. They are cruciferous. And for any person that really cares about your health, you want to make sure you're getting your cruciferous vegetables every day. Of course, everywhere you can, buy organic and eat them. You can always, for all those, you should steam them lightly. And then you can blanch them, use them in a cold salad. And if you don't have those every day, then take your compounding powders that give you all your cruciferous vegetables. That actually gives you more power. But the key is, just look at the studies that support why it's so good to have your cruciferous in our body. All right, now I know some of you are using your cruciferous. Good for you. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Phones up now for you to call in and share your points of view. Please do. Happy to have you on board. And just give us a call. And by the way, you can listen to the Daily Radio. Some of you may not have a computer or may not have internet access if you do. So just pick up the telephone and call 832-280-0066. 832-280-0066. Our call-in number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Happy to take your call. A couple things before we get there, though. Wanted to share some insights. Insights from Rob Boston, Alternet, and myself concerning what I'm sure you've heard time and again. Now, maybe you believe in that, and that's fine. But I'd like to put this in perspective, because how many times have we have to hear Rick Santorum, you know, attack John F. Kennedy because of he wanting to show that we should not have a separation between church and state? And what did he say? He wanted to throw up? Well, there's a reason you should take a moment, Rick. Pull back, you and Newt and the others, and ask yourself. You're knocking the secular elites. That's what you call everyone who believes there should be a separation. And today, more than ever, they're trying to cater to people who believe that if you're a religious person, that religion should extend itself into the control of laws and policies. A few lessons in history would help, however. For those of you living in the New York area, this is a reminder of the Flushing Remonstrance, 1657. Now, that was back when New York was called New Amsterdam. And back then, there was a state-established Dutch Reformed Church, and it controlled everything. In fact, other religions were banned from that entire area. You weren't allowed in the colony. And not only that, but you had to cough up money. And if you didn't, you could end up being put in jail, and they would confiscate your land. So everybody had to pay in New Amsterdam what was called church taxes. The law mandated that all children be baptized in the Reformed Church. New Amsterdam's leaders had a special antipathy towards Quakers. Members of that faith were barred from even entering the colony, and anyone who came across a Quaker was, you were told to turn them in. Why? Because they were not good people. And then they would give very steep fines to the Quakers. Well, what happened was, in 1657, 30 residents of the village of what is now Flushing, a part of Queens, sent a letter to Peter Stuyvesant. You've heard of Stuyvesant Village. Well, he was the director of the colony. And they simply said, please stop the persecution of the Quakers. And the signers argued that religious persecution wasn't in keeping with real Christian theology. And they all signed on. None of them were Quakers. But they believed that good Christians didn't prosecute and persecute others. Now, it should be noted that none of the signers themselves were protecting Quakers. They were simply arguing for the rights of others. Not surprisingly, this didn't get out too well. Some of the signers were thrown in jail and ordered to recant. Well, when at that time you were locked up in a filthy, vermin-ridden cell. And so then a lot of them recanted. But the remonstrance proved to be ahead of its time. But the signers were vindicated when religious liberty was ensured in the Bill of Rights in 1791. James Madison had what was simply a memorial and remonstrance against religious assertions assessment in 1785. You've all heard of Patrick Henry. He was the fiery patriot famous for uttering the line, "Give me liberty or give me death." But there was one area where Patrick Henry could not break with the British. All of his life he argued in favor of the church-state union. James Madison disagreed. And when Henry proposed a bill in 1785 to require all Virginians to pay a tax and to support teachers of the Christian religion, Madison swung into action. he was a relatively small person, James Madison, and he was from Virginia, and he wrote what many people consider one of the single most important documents that would later be used in different forms to ensure our rights. It was called Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments. Madison's memorial and his remonstrance is essential. It lists 15 reasons why no one should be forced to pay taxes to support religion. The broadside circulated throughout the state, and the petitions flooded the Virginia legislature demanding the defeat of Henry's bill. It was rejected. Now, after the defeat of Patrick Henry's bill, Madison used the momentum he gained to push Thomas Jefferson's Virginia statute for religious freedom through the legislature in 1786. The bill disestablished the Anglican Church in Virginia and ensured that no resident shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall he be enforced, restrained, or molested, or burthened in his body or goods to comply based upon civil capacities. So quite simply, virtually all major historians agree that the Virginia struggle reverberated nationally. 5 years later, James Madison helped draft the First Amendment, writing church-state separation in the federal constitution. So for those who start off with the idea that America was a Christian nation, they are wrong. But you're going to hear that over the next year 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times. All of the people saying that are simply not aware of the truth. Maybe they just don't know it. Maybe they do know it and are choosing to assume that the average American doesn't. Now, there was also a letter written by George Washington to the Touro Synagogue in 1790. Jews were uncertain of their status in the new nation of the United States of America. And even after the Revolution, many states retained established Christian churches, and some states even barred non-Christians from holding public office. So in 1790, 1 year before the Bill of Rights was adopted, members of the Touro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island, wrote to President George Washington to express their support for complete religious freedom. Now, George Washington's reply is a classic of religious liberty. He didn't say that America was a Christian nation, never said that. He didn't tell the Jews that they could expect toleration, but little else. Instead, Washington assured the members of the synagogue that they need have no fears, and he assured them that they were valued members of the American experiment of freedom of conscience. Here's what he wrote, and we should know this because it is a canon of ethics codified into law that no amount of chest beating, no amount of false patriotism, no amount of excessive national and religious fervor can challenge this. He said the citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. What he was saying was that the religious right today, the activists, the Ann Coulters, the Sean Hannitys, and all the rest who believe that Washington favored an official Christian America, were wrong. Just the opposite. Their vision was of a nation that favored Christianity by law, but that might tolerate other faiths? No. The father of our country explicitly rejected this vision in his missive. But they don't want you to know about it. I do. And then finally, let's wrap it up with two more. Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists in 1802. Now, although the Bill of Rights was adopted in 1791, it wasn't made binding on the states until Congress passed the 14th Amendment after the Civil War. After the Revolution, Connecticut retained its established church and the Congregationalism. Members of other religions were compelled to support the church through taxation, and if they didn't, they were harassed. Well, members of the Danbury Baptist Association were aware that Thomas Jefferson was a champion of religious liberty. They also knew Jefferson wrote the law that ended Virginia's state-established church. So in 1801, the Baptists wrote to Jefferson to thank him and express their hope that his view of religious freedom would someday come to Connecticut. Jefferson knew his reply would become public and decided to use it to make a pronouncement on his views about church-state relations. And he wrote a letter in January of 1802, and he said that that you have a right to your religious views. That right is solely between you and your God. And you do not hold yourself accountable to any laws based on that. He said, make no laws respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free express thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state, adhering to this expression of the supreme will of the nation in behalf of the rights of conscience. Ah, so our third president, in my opinion, our greatest president, talked about the wall. That's a metaphor. And that metaphor of a wall has infuriated the religious right for decades. And they've tried to do everything they can to dismiss that, but it doesn't get dismissed. And finally, you had John F. Kennedy. Now, there's a lot about Kennedy I don't like. He was a warmonger. He was a corporate Democrat. He got us into the Vietnam War. He assassinated the Dim brothers. He was extraordinarily ambitious. I believe his brother Robert Kennedy turned around his life and would have become, I think, one of the most important populist presidents ever, and would clearly have beaten any competition before they decided to have him assassinated. Don't for a second think that Sirhan acted alone. He did not. In any case, John F. Kennedy decided to address this whole idea of church and state in the Greater Houston Ministerial Association 1960. And this is the speech that Rick Santorum says makes him want to throw up. After all, Kennedy had a big anti-Catholic backlash going against him. All kinds of false rumors were spread that Kennedy would put his loyalty as a Catholic above being an American and impose Catholic doctrine on a nation that was still culturally Protestant. So with polls showing Kennedy running neck and neck with Richard Nixon, the Massachusetts senator decided to tackle the matter head on, and he gave a speech in 1960. Here's what he said. Quote, I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be a Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because of his religious differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source, where no religious body seeks to impose its will directly or indirectly upon the general populace or the public acts of its officials, where religious liberty is so indivisible that an act against one church is treated as an act against all, end quote. Keep in mind, during his presidency, short as it was, he put those words into actions. He rejected demands from the Catholic hierarchy to extend tax aid to Catholic schools, and when the Supreme Court struck down mandatory school prayer in 1962, Kennedy simply reminded people that, hey, you can pray at home. So separation of church and state isn't always respected today. Just look at all of the religious meetings that all the people, the presidents for the last six presidents have gone to. Look at all the people who control the religious right, which is about one-third of the Protestants in this country. They have a great deal of power. Look at the tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars we give for all these religious initiatives. We shouldn't give a nickel for any of this, in my opinion. We should have an absolute separation of church and state, and we should not allow anyone on the left or right in any way interfere with our First Amendment rights and our freedoms. Those are my thoughts. I'd like to hear yours. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go to our phones here in a moment. Just one other thing I want to mention, and I'll share this with you. Food police. This I found interesting. Mayor Bloomberg bans food donations to homeless shelters. Quote, apparently going without is more nutritious than having food that is not nutritionally perfect. At least in Michael Bloomberg's eyes it is. So anyhow, he's banning this. And I'm suggesting that when people are starving, literally have no food, to bring in another bureaucracy to make sure that all the food has certain health qualities is nonsense. And we should look at feeding people first and foremost. So when you're a billionaire and you never have to worry about where your next meal is coming from, you can be rather impervious to other people's needs. Let's go to the phones and see who we have online now. Let me see who we're talking with. Kay from Minnesota, your turn.
Hi, Gary. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Happy to help.
Just want to say you have a great show, and I really appreciate all the great work you do. I have some general questions. You were talking about, like nut butters and oats and stuff like that earlier. I've never heard you really talk about peanuts. Are they good or bad or nothing? They're just, just
okay,
a fat.
Well, first, a peanut is not a nut. It's a legume.
Okay.
Secondly, peanuts are grown on the ground. And therefore, generally in Georgia, where you have a moist soil, clay, and it's susceptible to what is called aflatoxin. And in fact, aflatoxin is measured on a regular basis in peanuts. If it's an organically grown peanut, and if it's been, that is one thing I would not eat raw. But if you have a roasted organic peanut, I don't see a problem with that, providing that you know you're not allergic to peanuts. Because peanut is a common allergen.
Okay.
And therefore completely different than a true nut that doesn't have that problem. Okay? But it's certainly a nutritious food. There's nothing wrong with peanut butter. It's the sugar and the homogenization and any of the emulsifiers that they put into it. But if you just have organic peanuts in a health food store, and you can go into a lot and make your own peanut butter, that's fine. Not a problem. Okay, all the best to you. Thanks for calling in. Let's go to Joan from New York. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Gary. I have a question. I had a backache, and then I went for a urine test, to check it out, and they found what they called mild hematuria in the urine. It didn't show up, but only in the test. And I went to my doctor. We had an ultrasound. Nothing showed up on that. My doctor recommended an endoscopy, but I asked if I could take some time and, maybe drink a lot of water or cranberry juice or something. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about this kind of thing.
Let's look at the bigger picture, because all pain in the body manifests in different ways, but all have something in common. It's a message. All pain is a message. And the pain message is sent by the body to the brain, signaling that disease or injury or strenuous activity has caused some kind of imbalance somewhere. And in fact, if we didn't have pain, how would we know that we were injured? How would we know that we had something seriously wrong with it? So it's not all pain that is bad. It's just, what can we do once we become aware of the underlying cause of the pain? So there, for the pain you're talking about, there are several things you can do. You could do acupressure and acupuncture. The primary difference being that the acupressure is applying a certain amount of what we know as contact healing. And contact healing is actually older than acupuncture. And one of the best types of contact healing is called shiatsu, S-H-I-A-T-S-U. It's a form of massage technique, and it's also called acupuncture without needles. And it actually helps restore the normal flow of qi, the life energy that flows through the body. And it follows meridian pathways through the body so that it energizes, opens up, and allows the healing to occur. And so that's safe and it's easy to use, as is acupuncture. And then you have what is called auriculture therapy. And that's the auriculture, A-U-R-I-C-U-L-A-R, involves stimulating the external surface, generally of the ear, to alleviate conditions throughout the body. Have you ever noticed when your ears are stimulated how you feel relaxed? It's much like reflexology when your toes are massaged. They correspond like your the toes correspond to the top of the forehead, and then as you get down the foot to the different parts of the body. But now they have a way of including an electrical stimulation and the use of acupuncture needles. And the use of this auricle is in diagnosis was first described in the 1950s by a French neurologist, Dr. Paul Nolier. But now they can use this, and then they send a slight electrical charge that can help stimulate a healing process. You can also use chiropractic, guided imagery, heat and cold, and different herbs. The herbs to help turn off pain are easy. Those are your angelica, black haw, cramp bark, rosemary, and valerian root. And then you can actually make a tea, a blue violet, catnip, chamomile, and gota cola with white willow and wood betony, and then put that as a poultice, and that can help substantial when it's topical on the body. And then hypnotherapy, and then pulsed magnets. Now, I know some research now that's state-of-the-art where they're using new electrical pulse magnets, where they put a magnet on a particular part of the body, and then depending upon the cause of the injury and the type of pain, they then set the computer that then stimulates a certain pulse wave into the body, and with some really outstanding results. And then you've got neuromuscular massage, reflexology massage, Reiki massage, Rolfing, though I don't recommend that generally, shiatsu, and Feldenkrais. And so those are the ones that are most effective. Qigong is also very good, too. Hope that gives you some insights. Thank you, Joan, for your call. And we'll go over here and see who else we've got. From California, Kevin. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Good. Where are you from in California?
Orange County, California.
Okay. How can we help you today?
Sure. Thank you. Well, I was wondering if I and actually a friend of mine who is, I'm 30 years old, turning 30 soon, and a friend of mine who is over 70, if we wanted to ask for a comprehensive blood work, what do you recommend we ask the lab?
Is he in fairly good shape? Does he have any obvious illnesses?
He does not. He's in,
okay.
Yes.
Good. Then he should have a complete male hormone panel. He
okay.
should also have a SMAC24. That will cover all the nutrients in the body. He should also have an antioxidant test to determine his antioxidant levels, and also C-reactive protein, homocysteine, fibrinogen. Those are also important because those are pro-inflammatory. And that will cover what I would suggest. Also, at that age, he probably has some heavy metals, so it wouldn't hurt to get a heavy metal test done at the same time. But also, you should have him do a very thorough oral examination. Have a holistic dentist examine his gums, because a lot of bacteria and viruses, when you get older, reside in the gum, go through the system, and can go into the heart. Okay, all the best to you, Kevin, and your friend. From Miami, Flory. Hi, Miami.
Hi, Gary. First of all, I want to thank you for keeping us informed and for all what you do. I'm extremely grateful for you. Now, my mother has been on statins many years, and I suspect that this has an impact on her getting Alzheimer's. I have a big conflict with all the conventional medicine treatment they have her on, and I don't take the responsibility to take care of that stuff, but I added some good stuff like alpha-lipoic acid, vitamin E, coconut oil supplements, and I asked her primary doctor to reduce her statins, and I added soy lecithin granulates. Now, they took her off the vitamin E because they say it's a blood thinner, and they left her on the poison of Plavix. The same happened with the iodine that I was giving her for the thyroid. They took her of that, and they gave her levothyroxine, another poison. And I don't know, and I ask you, how do I go and how safe it is to take care of all these prescribed medications they are giving her, which is a money-making machine on her, and put her and find a good protocol to treat her conditions?
Well, I'm assuming that she has elevated cholesterol.
Of course.
And that, so let's just start with one, all right? Because if you start with one, you're most likely to do some good things. You have to separate out what they're going to suggest and get your mother into the hands of a quality holistic physician, and I'm going to suggest a cardiologist, a holistic cardiologist, or holistic internist. Either one could help your mom. Now, once that's done, then they can wean your mom off these medications and start using garlic. That will naturally thin the blood. Vitamin C, the mixed whole fraction of the, or the different fractions as a whole of the vitamin E, not just alpha tocopherol, and then the tocotrienols. And of course, one of the most important ones is when you're given statins, it destroys coenzyme Q10, yet coenzyme Q10 is the single most important nutrient for your heart. Between 300 to 2,000 milligrams a day, plus NADH between 20 and 100 milligrams a day, that's absolutely essential. So I would absolutely demand that, you know, you have that kind of opportunity to get a different protocol into your mom. And then you'll start to see more often than not the with coenzyme A and L-carnitine, the cholesterol levels dropping down. Okay, all the best to you. Vincent.
Oh, hi. Thank you. My wife has been suffering from a skin condition called lichen planus. And her main discomfort, she's been trying to deal with it naturally, acupuncture and naturopathic physician, et cetera. But her main suffering comes from rather severe itching in the genital areas. And I'm wondering if you can help at all.
I would say that you have to take care of it internally and externally. Internally, you have to look and check for parasites, bacteria, candida, because this is frequently one of the conditions of a candida overgrowth. So a sugar-free, completely sugar-free, yeast-free diet for at least a month. No coffee, no dairy, no artificial sweeteners at all. And instead have 5 glasses of fresh vegetable juice a day, primarily cucumber, cabbage, and grapefruit. Then, and with caprylic acid, vitamin C, and garlic. And I would do that at least 5 times a day. I would then use green tea 3 times a day at 300 milligrams. And then topically, I would take a simple wash, and I would put 500 parts per million of colloidal silver, and I would wash the area gently and then allow the colloidal silver to remain on the skin. That will take care of anything that's on the skin, and in otherwise, you're cleansing the body from the inside out. That's what I would do. All the best to you. I'm Gary Knoll. We're up to the end of our program. I want to thank you all for taking your time and listening in. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.